We'll begin the House Committee on Transportation and Economic Development, February 11th meeting. I'd like to open a work session on House Bill 2335 for possible reconsideration.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Reed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote by which this committee passed House Bill 2335.
Representative Reed moves the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on House Bill 2335. Is there any objection? Hearing none, so ordered. Motion carries and the rules are suspended.
Mr. Chair.
Co-Chair Reed.
Mr. Chair, as a note of explanation for the rest of the committee, we've discovered after our action that the House Bill 2335 had what we believed to be an unnecessary subsequent referral to Ways and Means Committee, and we've since received the approval from the co-speakers to rescind that subsequent referral. So, therefore, Mr. Chair, I move that the subsequent referral to Ways and Means on House Bill 2335 be rescinded and that the bill be moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation be placed on the consent calendar.
Representative Reed has moved that the subsequent referral to Ways and Means on House Bill 2335 be rescinded, the bill be moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation and be placed on the consent calendar. Is there any discussion?
I think this was a bill that we moved the day that I was testifying in another committee. I don't know if there's if we're allowed to reopen the vote, and I'd be happy to vote if you want me to.
We'll do a roll call vote on it.
Great.
Further discussion? Seeing none, those of the opinion that the subsequent referral to Ways and Means on House Bill 2334 be rescinded and the bill be reported to the floor with a due pass recommendation and be placed on the consent calendar will vote aye, and those opposed no. The clerk will call the roll.
Representative Lindsay?
Absent. Excused. I'm sorry. Excused.
Aye.
Representative Widener?
Aye.
Representative Witt?
He's no longer a member.
Sorry. Representative Byer?
Aye.
Chair Sheehan? Vice Chair Sheehan?
Aye.
Chair Bant?
Aye.
Chair Reed?
Aye.
Aye. The motion carries. And with that, we will close the work session on House Bill 2335, and the matter is referred to the floor with a due pass. And we're now going to open an informational meeting on brownfield remediation. Representative Frederick.
Hello, good to see you all.
Glad you're here.
Thank you. I'm not sure whether the screen needs to come down or just how that works. There we are. And we hooked up. Sure whether there's... Oh, I see. Okay. Well, I will start, and if we can...
Do we need a few moments to get this operating?
That's just a picture that I wanted you to see. So once it comes up, you'll understand exactly.
Just a moment.
Sure.
Is that... Will we have a picture up in a few minutes, or do we need to take a break? Thank you. Go ahead, Representative.
Well, thank you very much, Chair Benz and Chair Reed and the members of the committee. I am Representative Lou Frederick from House District 43, North and Northeast Portland. I'm going to bring an issue before you that's been in front of me for decades. I live just three blocks from an identified brownfield. It's a small contaminated site, the former site of a service station and dry cleaners. It's unusable for anything as it exists today, and it's been that way for a long, long time, about three decades at this point. I don't bring this up because of one eyesore in my neighborhood, however. As you'll see in the information we have today, these sites are all over the state. In my district, there are about 150 of them that I know of. These are sites that are either already confirmed to be contaminated or, based on the history, carry a high suspicion that they are contaminated. This is not just an aesthetic program, although it's that. It's not just an environmental program, although it's definitely that. These sites are missing in action in terms of economic activity. They can't even be used for homes. They can't be used for businesses. They can't even be used for the functions they had in the past. When I was growing up, gas stations were everywhere, in urban and suburban rural communities, complete with underground storage tanks, which, by the way, has a really curious definition in terms of DEQ. They're called leaking underground storage tanks, LUS. So just think about it that way. Not sure where they came up with that. Many of those tanks are still there. They're leaking or have leaked into the ground for a long period of time. Photo finishing involved toxic chemicals, and those shops were fairly common. Dry cleaners used more toxic chemicals than they do now, and they didn't dispose of them the way that they should at that time. We understand now how to do this. Even in the early 1980s, I witnessed a mechanic pouring solvents into the ground behind his shop. He told me they'd always done it that way. Farm chemicals, including pesticides, were stored and disposed of in ways that we would frown upon now, and we prohibit them now for very good reasons. We know better. But the main point I want to get across is that these sites could be used for economic activity. They exist in residential, commercial, agricultural, and industrial areas. They can be returned to use without zoning changes and with only positive impact on the neighboring uses. Now, even the vacant ones are useless as open space because they're toxic. We could have infill in urban areas without a perceived increase in density. We could provide land for manufacturing and commercial establishments without encroaching on other uses. This is a reservoir of available space that's not being used. It may take a variety of legislative and administrative actions to remove the many barriers that exist to appropriately clean up these sites, but if we sort it out, we can have some of these win-wins that we're always talking about. A win for the environment and a big win for the economy. This is a way for business businesses of all sizes and the jobs they create. This specific bill provides a modest tax incentive for jobs created on former brownfields. I hope to amend it, as my intention was to propose a $1,000 credit per job rather than per employer or per site. This may have a revenue impact, although potentially offset by the revenue generated created by those jobs that are created. It would apply only, in fact, when jobs are created. The impact has not been estimated either on the expenditure or the offset. More importantly, this bill calls for a grant and loan program to fund up to 75% of the cost of the environmental studies required to determine the cost of the cleanup. Uncertainty as to final cost of cleanup and duration of liability is a major barrier to businesses contemplating developing these sites. The fiscal impact of this has not been estimated, but again, this addresses one of the most important barriers when a business contemplates developing a brownfield site for commercial or industrial use. I want to introduce Palmer Mason of the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality, who will have some more detailed information for you. Palmer?
Proceed, please, Palmer.
Co-Chair Vince, Co-Chair Reed, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Palmer Mason. I'm with the Department of Environmental Quality. Representative Frederick asked us to be here to talk a little bit about brownfields, and I want to echo his remarks in that we certainly see redevelopment of brownfields to be a good thing for the environment. It can eliminate public health risk and environmental risk, but it's also a good thing for economic development and the local economy. As he was pointing out, we're often talking about sites where the location has value. The location has the infrastructure, the water, the sewer, the roads, and it often has the proper zoning. So the only thing really holding back the property from redevelopment is the risk of contamination or the uncertainty over the contamination. And so we agree with him that this is an area that certainly DEQ and perhaps the legislature itself ought to look at to try to do a win for the environment and a win for the economy. He asked us to prepare some information for today, and the committee staff has, I think, given that to you, and so I wanted to walk you through what we provided today. And I apologize to the committee that I wasn't able to send this to you in digital form. It's our intent to go paperless, so I apologize that I only have hard copies of the documents. And also, I apologize to all the committee members that I wasn't able to get information for each of your districts. So what we did was we produced information for Representative Frederick's district and then the district of the two co-chairs. And what you see in that information is a list of the sites that DEQ knows of where there has been a release of a hazardous substance, or we have reason to believe there has been a release of hazardous substance. So I don't want to suggest that every site that you see in those three districts is an actual public health or environmental risk, but there's a likelihood to believe that they could be, or that they would actually necessitate cleanup, but again, there's a reason to believe that they might. And our purpose in sharing this information was to show if you take those three districts, you can see whether you're talking about rural areas, more suburban-style areas, or even rural areas of the state, there are a high number of potential cleanup sites all throughout Oregon. And certainly that's an environmental risk and a public health risk, and that's what DEQ focuses on. But as Representative Frederick pointed out, those may be missed opportunities for economic development. And so we just wanted to share this information with you. We thought that the maps might really speak to the geographic spread and the likelihood of finding a lot of these type of sites throughout Oregon. The other thing that we brought today that I wanted to share and talk about was some success stories that DEQ knows of where we used public money in part, not entirely, to clean up sites and turn sites into productive property again. And that is this handout that's called DEQ Orphan Site Success Stories. And our Orphan Site program is a program that has been funded with bonded money, and it allows us to go into sites where the owner is unable, unwilling, or can't be located. The owner, operator of the property, the responsible party, cannot be located. And in essence, those type of properties become a responsibility of the state to try to clean up. And we've used those dollars to go to those kind of properties and, again, turn an environmental health risk into an economic success story. And so you have an example in Astoria. You have an example in Portland. And then we picked an example in Klamath County, again, to show that this can also be a situation you see in the rural parts of Oregon. And I wanted to provide that information to you. And I can certainly take any questions the committee may have.
I have a couple to begin with. This situation, first of all, the scale is a little off on these maps. I want to point out that my district is 26,000 square miles, and my co-chair's is roughly a quarter of a square mile.
I was going to ask, Mr. Co-chair, I think it's slightly more than a quarter mile, but I was going to ask why you don't have any more detail on your map.
It's more detail. It's almost perfect. My question is this. If someone buys a house, and I'm actually talking about a situation in Baker City where some folks bought a house and discovered, much to their dismay, when they decided to convert from oil heat for their furnace to gas, that and they went to employ folks to remove the 30-year-old tank, they discovered it had been leaking. The distance between the tank and the groundwater was estimated to be about 200 feet below the house. So we knew that the oil that had escaped from the tank was going to take years to migrate down to that groundwater level. You may be familiar with the situation, maybe not. It's one of many, I'm sure. But they began the effort to remove the tank, and it took about $80,000 to chase the oil down 30 or 40 feet. The last I heard, they'd left the country, abandoned the house, because they simply couldn't afford that type of a cleanup. Mm-hmm. The interesting thing is that, I'm going to take a wild guess here and say that the vast majority of the oil was collected, captured, and hauled away long before they got to 40 feet below the house. So the question that I'm asking is, how much cleanup is enough cleanup? Right. And where are the standards for that that activity to be found, other than in just the good graces of the DEQ?
Co-Chair Vince, I will certainly do my best to answer the question from what I know, but I don't want to represent myself as the absolute expert, and we may very well have to have somebody else provide you more information. And I'm also not familiar with the particular instance you're talking about, but I would like to hear more and get in touch with our staff. And because we do have a cancer risk that we use to determine what is safe and what is appropriate for the environment. And that standard is in our rules and guides our activities. The other thing that we, I'm going to give you the cancer risk is basically like a 1 in a million risk that someone will be at higher risk for cancer based on the presence of the contamination. The other thing, though, that guides our process to clean up is we take what they call a risk-based corrective action approach. And that allows us to evaluate what is the use of the property, both at the present and in the future, and what would be an appropriate standard of public health and safety and environmental safety for that property. So maybe I can provide a couple of examples to try to explain that. And again, we're likely to need to have some more folks talk to this at a higher level of detail than I can. But if the property is a residential property, and there's a risk of contamination, I think most of us would see that as a greater risk, the fact that people could come in contact through their presence by living there and that type of thing. If the property is an industrial property and there's contamination, and we can ensure that the property will continue to be used as an industrial property, then the risk of exposure from terms of public health and safety is likely to be less, and so the level of cleanup would not necessarily need to be the same. And we approach this through a variety of ways. We approach it through determining how much cleanup actually needs to happen in terms of, you know, putting machinery in the property to control either the spread of the plume or prevent the plume from reaching groundwater, to actual, you know, dirt and dig and haul, as they call it, taking the dirt out and removing the contamination. But we also do other things, more creative approaches. We will do things like what we call engineering controls. So over the property, we may cap it with a layer of cement or a layer of clean fill. And the idea is that we put the contamination beneath a barrier, and so the risk of exposures are not as great. Or the other thing we may do is something called institutional controls, where there's legal mechanisms in place to ensure that the property will not, say, go from industrial to residential and then increase that likelihood that someone may come in contact with the contamination. So those are some of the different things that we do. Again, definitely would like to hear more about the particular situation that you're talking about with this leaking. It sounded like a heating oil tank that the person had at their home. And maybe, you know, that was something that we did that was not appropriate, and would certainly like to investigate that further.
Chair Benz, if you don't mind, there's another aspect to this that I want you to understand. This bill that I'm bringing forward here is a companion to another bill that looks at the issues of liability. There are, in fact, three bills, one in the Senate, two in the House, dealing with the question of liability and how owners and the DEQ can work together better to eliminate or at least minimize the liability issues that are presently in shape because of past efforts. This bill is an attempt right now to try to provide an incentive to brownfields that are cleaned up so that we actually have the ability to put jobs on those brownfields. So that's the approach that I'm taking there.
Thank you. Are there questions from the committee?
Thanks very much, Mr. Chair. So first of all, let me just say, I think that the finding a bill, let me pander for a moment, finding a bill that is truly something impacting your district that also impacts a bunch of other districts, that is also linked to not only, you know, something that's costing us stuff, but that could yield jobs, is really great. And I want to give a shout out and some plaudits. We've had some significant conversation about tax credits generally, and you and I have talked about that. And so I want to put a couple things on the record, at least if only to be only mildly partial. You said some things around causation and how we know that it's how the existence of this tax expenditure will be the thing that yields the additional job. Right, and we have some confidence the brownfield cleanup is a little different than some other conduct that might be happening anyway. Say anything you can about the causal link and making it clear that the jobs that are created are really linked to the tax break, and also talk a little bit about projected overall cost to the extent it's not only redundant.
Well, actually, the last part is exactly the point. One of the problems that you have is an uncertainty about the cost right now of cleanup. And if a business person who is looking at going in, knowing that if they decide to put 10 jobs on that particular site, they know that they've got at least $10,000 coming back in terms of a tax credit, that's a guarantee for them at this particular point. That's the idea, is to provide for them some kind of guaranteed amount of money, but only if those jobs are in fact taking place on that site. This bill is patterned after a bill that came went through the state of Pennsylvania several years ago, and the result has been a number of companies, in fact, being able to rely on the money because of a tax credit. Before they even begin the process of cleaning up the brownfield, knowing that that's going to be available to them.
I should also acknowledge that my impression is it's a problem in my district, but I haven't seen a map. So if you have time to produce any additional, I'd love to get in the queue. And then the other, let me just say for the record, you can respond if you want. Don't feel obliged to. That my support for any new tax expenditure, new tax credit, will be related to our ability to have additional tools to modify those that are passed as well as those that are already on the books, right? And particularly after. I mean, I've been looking at this stuff for a while, and I even got some sticker shock when the Department of Revenue was offering some of that information. So anyway, I like this one. See, this one seems pretty good, and, you know, I'd love to do a bunch of other stuff, too.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Smith. Committee.
Questions. I have just a couple more, Palmer. And this is to build on the representative's suggestion that something needs to be done first to make these properties more available, but more to the point of helping those who unwittingly find themselves faced with this really expensive situation.
Right.
And if I understand what happens correctly, and they do, landowner discovers that there's been a release of some sort of dangerous chemical or petroleum or something on their property, and then is either notified by the DEQ that has happened or lets the DEQ know about it, and then the cleanup exercise begins. In that process, the landowner ends up paying not only for the cleanup exercise but also for the DEQ's involvement. Am I correct?
Co-Chair Benz, that is correct in, I think, many of the cases. The landowner in that case also has the option of doing the cleanup and then providing information, proof, if you will, that the cleanup is sufficient. But often what landowners elect to do is go through a process where they work with DEQ on the cleanup and the steps of the cleanup, and in those instances, I think you are correct, they are paying for DEQ staff time and overhead. And if I can, I think part of the problem here is the nature of cleanup work itself. All these contaminants, all these pollutants are things that aren't usually visible to us, so we don't know exactly how the plume has spread out or how the contamination has extended, and that often makes it difficult to say with certainty what the cost would be. And I have no doubt that that's very frustrating for someone who's paying the bill, be it a homeowner or a landowner or a business owner, but that is part of the nature of working in cleanup is the stuff is all underground and you don't know exactly where it is spreading. And it involves a great deal of money and expense to determine through monitoring and other sampling techniques to figure out where that contamination has gone.
And sadly, the way that works is the testing is extraordinarily expensive, and the cleanup even more so, and the oversight by the DQ adds to that total cost. The situation in Baker City is not a situation that is intended to illustrate the DEQ's failures. It's intended to illustrate the difficulty in knowing when to stop. Because the most of the contamination had been removed, that which was left might never reach groundwater. Okay. If it did, it would be a million years from now. And so the question becomes, how much do we spend in today's dollars for something that would happen 200 or 300 years or never from now? And it's what is missing from the statutory structure that we have in place, the regulatory one, is a means of calling an end to it. The engineering at all levels is extraordinarily expensive. And I don't know if you can share with us what the DEQ is doing to try to control those expenses and to control these fees and, more to the point, put a lid on it, because carried to its extreme, none of us can afford it, period. So my question would be, could you share with us or the department what it is that it's doing to address the issues I've raised and that the representative is raising?
Right. Co-Chair Bence, if I may, I would like to bring back, you know, the people who can really, really answer your questions. I don't think I'm going to be able to at the level of detail that you're asking for, but I hear your questions, and I will certainly take it back, and we will get the right folks either in front of this committee, or if you would like to have, you know, a sidebar conversation in your office or any of the members of the committee, we'll certainly do that.
And just to build on, again, what Representative Fredericks brings to us, the fear that any rational human being has of stepping into that quagmire freezes these pieces of valuable property, and there they sit. So it seems to me that the DEQ holds the key to reducing that level of concern and needs to use it because the cost to our economy is significant, both in not having that property available and in the actual cleanup. And so it would be a welcome if you would make that recommendation back to the we two co-chairs. We would appreciate that.
Absolutely. Representative Bence, committee. As I said, there are two other bills, three bills that deal with the liability issues. I understand that I'm not sure which committee it is. Is it Water and Environment? I believe they're going to be taking up having one day in a week or so to look at just those bills to talk about those kinds of issues. So that's something we might look forward to. I'm hoping that it creates a new economic activity among all of the brownfields that we're seeing across the state.
Thank you, Representative Widener.
Thank you, Chair. This is kind of a comment and something else for him to take back to DEQ, but this is a bigger problem than just the individual property, because it's neighboring properties that get affected by this. Right now, I know of a situation in a town where there was a fuel leak, and there are six properties that can't be sold because of that. No banks will touch a loan. No banks will even do anything on any of the properties because of these fuel leaks and because of the regulation that comes from the feds and from the state. And I think we need to look at how we're doing business to where we're helping businesses get back in business rather than the state ending up owning their property from the cleanup process and it sits there and doesn't get used. So this is a very serious issue that we're dealing with way beyond this. And I compliment you for bringing this forward, Representative Frederick, because I am somebody who is a supporter of tax credits to take care of issues like this and incentivize people to pick up these properties and put them back into good health and into a usable manner again. But we have to let the banks know that, hey, you're not going to be liable for this because a bank won't touch the give a loan on them for them to go clean this property up. So these are things that we need to look at very seriously when we're doing this.
Representative Reed?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had a chance to look a little closer at the maps just as a sort of introduction to my question here, and noted another interesting thing about the maps of our two districts. It's an interesting, I assume it's an acronym, LUST sites. And wondering if it's District 60 that might be the most lustful district in the state.
How many do you have?
I didn't count them, actually, but there's quite a few in District 60, I noticed. The question I'm wondering about, if I heard the description of the concept accurately, is a tax credit per job, and I'm assuming, though we don't have the bill in front of us at the moment, that there's a specific dollar figure. So I wonder if you could tell us about how you arrived at that dollar figure and what evidence you might have gathered to indicate that that's a sufficient number to motivate the sorts of behavior we're seeking.
Thank you, Chair Reed and Chair Benz and committee. I was the $1,000 figure was after looking at a number of other states around the country and other proposals that had come forward. It seemed not a great amount, but something that would be significant for people to look at if a business person was looking at that. And a relatively easy to, frankly, if you have put a coffee shop there, the baristas are going to make enough money that $1,000 it would pay back pretty quickly. That's what I was looking at.
Brief follow-up, please. And do you have a sense of what, just in terms of rough orders of magnitude, what the revenue impact might be?
Well, again, I think that the question really for me, the way that I've approached this is that you really do not have a revenue impact unless there are jobs created, and that's the way that I've looked at it. I recognize that that's perhaps not the way that things go here, and I'm just learning that pattern right now. But the fact is that we don't know how many pieces of property might then be moved through. What kind of jobs might be created on those properties? They could become condos. They could become small manufacturing plants. So there's quite a range there, and it's unclear how many people would take us up on this offer.
Maybe a brief comment then, Mr. Chair. I understand, and I was only smiling because earlier in the week I asked a similar question of one of our other colleagues who also had a proposal around tax credits. And you're right, of course, to note that there's a lot of uncertainty around that number, but as we construct the budget, I guess I was asking more specifically about what the Legislative Revenue Office might tell us. I'm guessing we don't have that number yet.
We do not have that number yet. That's right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Further questions? Seeing none, thank you very much. Thank you for bringing the bill, and thank you for coming in and sharing with us, and I look forward to the materials.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you.
With that, we're continuing the informational meeting, and we will move now to corporate income and excise tax credits. Representative Reed, Ray Burstead, and Dennis McNanny. Please.
No, I'd be happy to have one.
Please.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I'm Tobias Reed, State Representative for District 27. I'm going to choose to consider that the room nearly cleared as just a coincidence that I came around to this.
Sure.
We're here today to just prepare you for a hearing that we might have a subsequent date around, I think, another option that might be on the menu, as our co-speaker indicated earlier in the week, around economic development incentives. And the difference between this concept and some of the others is that this would be aimed at or based on payroll. So it's aimed at a different sort of business. I think as a state, we've done a good job, and there's obviously lots of rooms we'll be taking up in this committee of ways to consider improving our efforts. But we've done a good job at incenting and attracting a certain type of business that tends to have more of their investments in capital infrastructure. This bill, or this concept, seeks to complement that approach by basing some incentives on payroll for a different sort of business whose major investments would be centered on human capital and spending on payroll. So when we get to that concept, there's lots to talk about the specific mechanisms, the safeguards that might be part of that concept, and would note, I'm not sure if others will testify in more detail, but it's one of several similar concepts that I believe are now in the possession of this committee and in other places in the legislature. So it is my intent simply to highlight and call to your attention the idea that payroll-based incentives ought to be part of our consideration as well. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee.
Thank you. And you are?
Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Ray Burstead. I'm the president of the Strategic Economic Development Corporation, a private economic development company operating in Marion and Polk counties. We serve public contracts with Marion County, Polk County, and the City of Salem, as well as we have 500 private members who support our organization. Just as a brief background, I've been doing this work in economic development for about the past 15 years. The last five of that being in Oregon and other years in states bordering Oregon. And I understand competition and economic development opportunities, and I understand that our economy is not in good shape right now. I have a little bit different philosophy on why our economy is where it is right now. You know, everybody talks about a recession. Traditionally, if you look back at history, we've slid into recessions and we've flown out of recessions. And we're not flying out of this, so in my mind, this is more of an economic reset than an economic recession. And as a reset, I think we have to look at it differently. Jobs are what are going to bring us out of this recession. And if we don't do something to incentivize jobs in Oregon, we're going to be left behind. The Oregon Economic Development Association requests your support for the state payroll-based business development incentive that was just you just learned about. The members of our association are local partners who carry out much of the state's economic development and private sector initiatives. We're local economic development practitioners, often responsible for the development and delivery of multi-jurisdictional proposals to enable business expansions and to compete with other states for recruitment of economic development opportunities. Oregon needs a competitive advantage to influence multi-state companies with Oregon facilities to expand here and not someplace else. Case in point, we just competed with Kansas on a major expansion for one of our local companies, Garmin Industries. If it had not been for our enterprise zone and our ability to put together a workforce training program for that company, the incentives that they were offered in Kansas outweighed ours 2-1. But they had an existing facility here. Their home office was in Kansas. They felt that the way that we were able to expeditiously support their need to do what they needed to do here made them make the decision to be here. In recent years, Oregon has competed head-to-head with states such as Texas, Utah, Arizona, Nevada, Washington, and Idaho. The policymakers of those states are willing to put more incentives on the table due to a return on investment. These policymakers recognize these incentives end up creating more general fund dollars than they would otherwise get. Oregon is fortunate to have many examples of competitive recruitments and expansions. We are often credited with out-hustling our competition, not outspending them. While we may be successful in some of our efforts, traded sector businesses still have to make location decisions based on the bottom dollar. While Oregon is a great place to live and work, and while our overall business costs give us a great competitive advantage, we must improve our standing. The payroll-based business development incentive will be critical in this effort. I thank you for your consideration and for listening to my testimony on this matter.
Thank you. And that leaves, so we'll take questions after we've heard from all three of you. So, Mr. McNanny?
Yes, thank you, Co-Chair Benz, Co-Chair Reed, I guess you're down here, and the other members of the committee. My name is Dennis McNanny. I'm the Executive Director for the Oregon Bioscience Association. Bioscience means lots of things to lots of people, so I just give you a brief context. In Oregon, our members include 185 companies that span the gamut of medical devices, therapeutic companies, diagnostic companies, software companies, agricultural companies, and I believe soon biofuel companies. What's interesting about our industry from a financial perspective is it's quietly grown into a $4.1 billion industry in Oregon, employing 14,300 people, with a total overall impact of $37 billion in the state. The average wage of a bioscience worker is $56,000 per year, and I believe it exemplifies the kind of jobs that we're trying to create and that were discussed, and the kind of jobs a bill like this is targeted to attract. The companies that have chosen to do business in Oregon represent world-class leaders in several categories. I'll just give you one example of a company called Biotronic, which is located in Lake Oswego, which is the second largest producer of heart defibrillators, implantable defibrillators, and implantable pacemakers. I know of very few people in the state that would know that fact. And it's sort of symbolic of our industry as being as quiet as it has been. In the case of Biotronic, they manufacture, design, and do all the quality control in the United States, and yet these products are the leading export, the leading producer, Biotronic, of pacemakers and defibrillators in Germany. So number two company in the world. I could go through a list of companies, which would include Welch Allyn, Life Technologies, Bend Research, which are all world-class companies. As, however, world-class companies, they have their choice as to where to expand, and what we're talking about today is making that choice much more attractive to do that expansion here in Oregon. I know, for example, Tyco, Biotronics, Welch Allyn, which collectively probably employ 2,000 Oregon workers, are all considering expansions, but unfortunately they do business in six or seven states collectively and are now faced with a decision as to whether to do this in Oregon. As an ROI for the state of Oregon, which I think you have to consider as you start considering how you're going to use the scarce resources we have, one of the advantages of investing in these sorts of bills, particularly for bioscience, is this is a very sticky industry. When you build manufacturing facilities, which is one of the areas that Oregon still holds several advantages as compared to other states, You must consider that bioscience facilities are typically FDA inspected, and therefore they're not moved very quickly. And I think that's where we have an advantage as an industry and as a state to build a 10-year growth, a 10-year recovery around an industry that stays where it's built. Thank you very much for taking my testimony. Also included has been the economic impact study that deals specifically with the bioscience industry. That was provided as well as a summary of that document.
Thank you. Do we have questions for the panel? Representative Weiner.
Just real quick, why would the bioscience businesses not want to expand here?
It's really not so much why they wouldn't want to expand here, but why they would be wooed to another state. I can name Wisconsin, Kentucky, Tennessee, and Ohio, which has been extremely aggressive. And I'll give you one example specifically, which is a small device company in Bend that recently completed phase three trials on a new catheter technology. This is a company founded by a thoracic surgeon. Ohio came and was prepared to give him his entire second round of equity funding as well as economic developments if he was willing to relocate in Ohio, which he was in the process of doing when he fortunately won Angel Oregon, which essentially saved the jobs that exist today, but probably a manufacturing facility for the future. And it would have been a difficult decision. In fact, he had already decided he was going to stay in Oregon, but recapitalize the company in Ohio.
Further questions? I have a couple. Is there a tax credit that you think is more specific to the area that you're talking about, or is this just a general overall credit for all that you're hoping for?
Well, I would assume that there would be other tax credits that would benefit our industry. This one is particularly attractive because it's based off payroll benchmarks that I think our industry can meet or exceed.
And a question for Mr. Burstead. You've been working in the economic development arena for 15 years.
Yes, sir.
So as you look at us here, what's your recommendation that we do that would be best in this arena? Is that what we're talking about, the very best type of credit, or have you seen others that we should be focusing upon?
You know, there's a lot of different programs, Chairman Benz, that states offer. I'll give you an example, Texas. Of course, Oregon doesn't have a sales tax. Texas has a 7% sales tax. 2% or the top 2 cents of that sales tax dollar goes to economic development. They build manufacturing facilities without clients. They have vacant facilities ready for companies to move into, and they give them to them. We can't compete with that, and I'm not suggesting that we do that. But I think an initiative like this would be one more arrow in our quiver, so to speak, that when we go out and we're recruiting these companies in other jurisdictions and trying to convince them that Oregon is the best place for them to have their companies, they can take advantage of all the other life things that we talk about and the costs of doing business in Oregon being what they are. This would just add one more thing that we can hook them with, if you will, to get them to make that decision to move to Oregon. I think it's an imperative incentive that we need to seriously consider.
This reset you mentioned, it's interesting because it's almost as though we collectively as a state take our tax dollars and use them to attract, bribe, encourage folks to come to this state. And it seems like Texas has used a sales tax and using 2 cents of everybody's money to build those warehouses to attract them to the state. So is it your thought that for the indefinite future we need to engage in this bidding war and continue this try to offer more to these folks to get them here? Is that our future?
No, and that's a difficult point to address. I guess my point would be that if we don't have incentives in our portfolio to talk to companies about, we're not even going to get consideration. As I said in my opening statements, we have out-hustled a lot of our competitors for projects. In my estimation, we out-hustled Kansas for the garment expansion, which added 250 new jobs here in our city. I think we out-hustled all the states on the East Coast for the Wachovia facility that brought over 600 jobs to this area. We have never had more incentives than anybody else. But the incentive game, which I thoroughly hate, is a game we have to play. And if we're not willing as a state and as an economy to step up and make some concession, whether it be a business energy tax credit or whether it be some other form of tax credit, payroll-based tax credit, quite frankly, the corporate site selectors are going to walk right past us, and they're not even going to look back. So we can be competitive. This will help us be more competitive.
Mr. Chair, may I add something to that, too? I think it's important to acknowledge and celebrate the successes we've had as a result of hustle. Because I think Mr. Burch says right, we don't have the same incentives that others do. And in a sense, it's a question of sort of making lemonade with the lemons we have. But I think that makes it even more important for us to be selective and to build on the competitive advantages we have in Oregon. We've seen lots of examples of clusters developing that hopefully then develop the momentum on their own that then are less needing of those kinds of incentives. Biosciences is but one example, but that sort of menu, again, to use that analogy, of tools that can be used in hustling is especially important.
And further questions? Representative Smith first, and then Representative Wagner.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Yeah, and I mean, you know, Representative Reed, you have a chance to, you're sort of one of a leading thinker on some of this stuff. It would be valuable to have, you know, input from SoReady and other folks. I mean, we have on how we can not only on what are alternatives to that, you know, to that sort of necessary, you know, but sometimes unfortunate game, but also on how to play it best. And this might be the thing that's related to the chair's question, but also in terms of flexibility, right? A challenge we're facing in our state, and I'm going to try to say this a different way so I'm not just repeating myself to a slightly different group of people, but is we've been doing, I think, some really smart things with tax breaks and tax credits for a long time. The challenge is at some point we're getting to a place where it gets harder to do that, which doesn't make our tax break environment better. right? It makes it less flexible, makes it harder to do. Every time somebody comes up with one, it says, well, I don't know, we got $31 billion worth of tax expenditures total. What's the upper ceiling compared to the general fund of $27 billion? And if you guys have thoughts on ways to add flexibility in our existing crop of tax breaks and are willing to apply sort of business acumen and economically responsible acumen to thinking about what would be the ideal set of structures for this, I think there's a way to make it so these sets of tools are around and strong for the next generation of legislators and economic developers.
If I could expand just a little bit on the answer I gave to you, I think research and development tax credits specifically for my industry, since we're driven based off of R&D capital, innovation capital, which we've been successful in getting in the form of grants, but certainly tax credits related to research and development would be valuable. But getting back to your comment, which I think is also, as we address our legislative agenda, it's important to balance, say, tax credits with access to capital. So young companies that are just getting off the ground as startups have the capital to even take advantage of the kinds of opportunities that tax incentives can bring. So we're looking for that balance, and I think that's represented in our broader legislative agenda.
One quick point, and thank you again. Right now, if I have a request for proposal from a site selector, and we've got a company in Arizona looking to relocate and possibly select Oregon, I have one tool that I can use if it's not a renewable energy company, and that's the enterprise zone. Without the enterprise zone, I would have nothing to offer that company, nothing. This, everybody has enterprise zones. All the states have enterprise zones. There are 20 states now that have these types of tax credits for payroll-based tax credits. They're growing, and we need to be part of that. And I think if we can add something like this to, as I said, to our quiver, it will be something that will help our state down the road immensely.
President Widener.
Thank you, Chair. Representative Reed, just a quick question for you, because we had the speaker here the other day, and you'd went after him for funding schools with a tax credit that he was proposing for helping our construction industry that's hurting severely. So just to get a feel of what direction you're wanting to take our committee and everything, what kind of tax credits do you support and what kind of tax credits don't you support? Are you looking at something broad across the board to help all industry, or are you wanting to select specific industries?
Mr. Chair, Representative Widener, I would respectfully quarrel with your description. I think it's appropriate, and I would expect the same questions as you've indeed given me about what the costs are. I'd point out that I asked the same question of Representative Frederick about what he expects the proposals that he's talking about to cost. I think that's exactly our job in this committee, as we've talked about when Dr. Warner was here, that it's our job to look at the various proposals and decide which of them are meritorious and which of them are the best use of the scarce resources we have. It's very consistent what we're presenting here as a concept for consideration amongst the other things that we might be considering. There are other versions of this that are in our committee and elsewhere in the legislature, as I mentioned earlier, that might be funded in a variety of ways. I think we will likely hear from the Business Development Department about some other proposals that are consistent with this but are funded in different ways. None of this, I would say, is worthy of advancing until we have very specific and good answers about how those things cost, or what they cost, and how they relate to the broader budget. Next week in the Revenue Committee, we'll be hearing the latest quarterly revenue forecast, which will give us more information about those choices. And I think it's very appropriate for us to be asking difficult questions about all of these things that are in front of us.
To follow up. So at this point, we want to get everything out on the table so we can figure out what's the best way to go forward and work with you guys on doing that, it sounds like, is what we want to do.
Mr. Chair, Representative Widener, I think that's right. I think, as I mentioned in an answer, a previous comment, the other thing to keep in mind is to look at what really are our opportunities in Oregon, where are the things that we are better than others. I've asked that question about, we talked a little bit in our last hearing, and we'll return to that subject later in this one, I think, about film. And there are questions about where do we have competitive advantages that can't simply be replicated by other states. what things do we do well. And it's not obviously just tax credits, it's also the infrastructure. Texas has, as we've heard, infrastructure that's attractive. Bioscience needs well-educated people who have scientific skills. So these all fit together, but where we have specific advantages can also be a big clue to how we should be spending our limited resources.
Further questions? Yes, Reverend Sheehan.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Fox, you mentioned not wanting to play the incentive game and not liking that. I'm with you. I don't like that either. Are there states that don't have to do this? Are there states that just naturally get businesses wanting to move there? What does that look like versus what we've got? Or states that offer lesser incentives? Can you speak to that a little bit?
For the record, Chair Benz and Member Sheehan, I'm Ray Burstead. Ron Fox, representing Solready, could not be here today. I am testifying in his place. Sorry, I don't think that got changed on the agenda. Your question is, are there states that don't offer incentives?
That are successfully recruiting businesses. You mentioned the incentive game and, you know, that.
I know of no states right now that are offering no incentives.
Okay, do you know the state's offering less, or do we have to be more aggressive?
We're probably, if I were going to pick a number, and just from my experience, I would say in the incentive game, so to speak, that we're probably in the lower quadrant of the states that offer incentives. I think there are 75% of the states in the lower 48 offer more incentives than we do. Except, and I have to quantify that, in relation to renewable energy projects where we're able to utilize the business energy tax credits. In that situation, we are very competitive.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Further questions? Thank you very much for the discussion. Great summary of what we're trying to do with these tax credits.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And with that, we will close the informational meeting and move to the reopening of the public hearing on House Bill 2167. To follow in the terminology suggested by my co-chair, this is probably a topic more relevant to less descriptive phrases than the one you last tried to apply it to, that is underground storage tanks. And with that, Vince Porter, I think we would like to start with you. I think we may have ended with you, unless you have... Unless you finished last time. But if you haven't, please come up and share with us your remaining remarks.
Thank you, Chair Benz, Chair Reed, members of the committee. I finished my written testimony. I did have, I was hoping to submit two DVDs that were created on that Wednesday that two people wanted to submit for the record and wanted to play them. A couple people providing examples of what it's meant to them, this particular program. So I don't know what the timing is, if we have timing to show this now, or if you'd like any questions to ask of me, it's at your discretion.
How long are they?
I told them to keep it, I think both are 2 minutes each.
2 minutes each. And are we in a position to show them is really the question.
Yes, I believe there's a DVD player.
Just the DVD?
No, it's just DVD.
Mr. Chair, if anyone would be qualified, I'd submit film clips.
Yes, I guess that's true. If there are 2 minutes, why don't you go ahead with them?
Okay, thank you.
Do you have some? Do they tell us who they are and so forth?
I will. I'll give you, Chair Benz, I'll give you a little bit of a background. The first one is from a casting director who's probably come and testified several times before, Alana Venker. She can't be here because she's in Berlin this week at the Berlin International Film Festival, and she gives her reason why in the testimony of why she's going to that festival.
Is the projector warmed up?
Thank you. Okay, if it's... Do we have a film person in the room?
Are we able to dim the lights
down? I think it would be an audio-video engineer.
If
that was the point of my...
There, I see something coming up.
Yeah, it's warming up.
Okay.
Okay.
Benz, do you want us to take a little break for a moment?
Chair Benz, hopefully I was not a member of the AV club in high school, so I'm going to try the other one. It may be that this one just doesn't play on this DVD player.
Mr. Chair, she's going to the Berlin Film Festival. Did she send it back? Is it a European DVD?
Maybe so.
She sent it as a file that we downloaded and we did test, so I'll try the other one.
Who is this we would be listening to?
These are three gentlemen who work on film crews that have, as a result of the last few years, been able to start a small business that has expanded their possibilities.
And do we... Oh, go ahead. How about this?
We'll play around and see if it's just not playing.
It's
so.
Not. And we're bringing someone up, I think, to take a look at it. So while we're waiting, why don't we go ahead and...
Substantial
companies.
We want to go.
Now require the addition of other employees. My name is Mark. I have made a career in Portland alongside many friends and fellow Oregonians. I was asked to do a short video about the economic effect of the film industry here.
More volume?
It's very simple. Many of us started with nothing. Now we have an impressive infrastructure that caters to bringing films to the state and doing a very good job while they're here. People like myself, Doug, and Bruce...
That's why we do this.
I can narrate if you would like.
Yeah, that's fine. Why don't we set this aside and we'll go ahead with other folks that are signed up unless you want to say a few words. Then we'll come back to this when we can have our act together, so to speak. We'll proceed.
Yeah, Chair Benz. I'm done with I presented all that I had to say, but I'm certainly willing to answer any questions that the committee may have.
Yeah, we may well have questions for you to kind of be an entree to our discussion at the end of the presentations. So thank you very much for that. And then if you want to work with Debbie to see if we can figure out how to make this work, it's going to be a little disconcerting. And then we'll go ahead and try to take some other... Actually, we're going to take about a two-minute break and get this straightened out, and then we'll come back.
Okay.
Channel 2 News would like that.
So we also posted this on our website, on our blog, and so hopefully this will work.
I have made a career in Portland alongside many friends and fellow Oregonians. I was asked to do a short.
That's about as loud as it gets. We could provide you the website
of the film industry here.
Yes, if you wish, you could go ahead and provide us the website. We'll take a look at it.
Yeah.
Started with nothing.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Now we have an impressive infrastructure.
Okay, with that, we have we're using the same sign-up sheet that we used, back on February 9th. And I'd like to call Daniel Eisenbeis and Jennifer Yoakum up, since time is limited. City of Portland.
Chair Benz, Chair Reed, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Daniel Eisenbeis with the City of Portland. With me here today is Jennifer Yoakum, the Mayor's Deputy Chief of Staff. The Mayor would have liked to have been here today. However, he is on a business retention trip to Spain to talk with one of the city's larger employers in the clean energy sector. Jennifer will be providing the substance of our testimony today. However, you do have a copy of written testimony from the Portland City Council in support of House Bill 2167, and we're both available to address any questions you may have.
Thank you. Chair Benz, Chair Reed, and members of the committee, again, for the record, my name is Jennifer Yoakum, and it's a pleasure to be here with you today. I thank you for the opportunity to testify. I also want to thank you for the state's leadership on this issue. The City of Portland is your partner in support of the film industry. We provide, from our Portland Development Commission, we provide a dedicated staff person to make sure that film crews have streamlined processes and other resources when they come into town to film. And we partner with Vince Porter at the Oregon Film Office on the state's recruitment efforts. So I've had a bird's eye view into exactly what the state's been up to over the last several years. As you take the necessary and critical look at these incentives, we ask you to consider a couple of points. You know, we're the proximity that we have to Los Angeles. We're not going to be Hollywood, but we could be Hollywood North, as it were. We need to capitalize on that proximity. We have inherent creative talent in our city and around the state, and we have incredible landscapes and a diversity of architecture in our towns and our cities that film production crews love to work with, but we can't even be at the table for the conversation about the assets that our state has without these tools. The Oregon Production Investment Fund and the Greenlight Labor Rebate have been crucial in attracting film and television over the last several years. So what about real numbers? And what about the real people? So here are a couple of examples. $52 million. That's the number of direct dollars spent in the Portland metropolitan region as a result of film production recruitment through OPIF. 417. Those are the number of local hires in the metro region during the season 3 of Leverage, including hires in some of our toughest hit industries like construction. $1,000 a week. That's the economic boost that a print company in Southeast Portland got from working on a production in the trough of last year's recession. 12 to 20%, that's the percentage of the workforce at Nighthawk Securities in Clackamas County. That's the percentage of the workforce that was working on production-related security jobs last year. And a number that, you know, might not seem as tangible, but when it comes to branding and earned media, 200, over 200 actually, is the number of mentions in national media outlets in the last month about the City of Portland and its unique qualities as a direct result of a television show shot in Portland. So those are some numbers. But as you take this critical look at the incentive programs, we also ask you to consider the future of, you know, content creation and the knowledge economy. It's only going to grow. The internet traffic for video has grown exponentially. I think it's going to be approaching half of the internet traffic what consumers are looking for on the internet next year. That's what it's projected to do. So we know it's a powerful force. We know it's growing. We do ask for your support of House Bill 2167, extending and expanding the Greenlight Labor Rebate and the Oregon Production Investment Fund. And I'll take any questions if you have them.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Just a couple. The numbers are really large that you've given us, and our tax credit is really small. So the question is, how does it happen that this little bitty tax credit of $7.5 million would be so important to the number, I think you said, $52 million? In other words, if we dropped it tomorrow, wouldn't these people still be here?
Right. I think that's the question that we were wrestling with a little bit on Wednesday about causality. I'm going to refer to Dan a little bit about potential changes.
Well, the $52 million figure that is cited came from the Oregon Film and Video Office. It is specific to 2009 and the Portland metropolitan region in terms of direct spending as the result of OPIF recruitment. My understanding from talking with Mr. Porter is that there is additional demand out there for productions that might locate in Oregon that are locating to other states because we're effectively spending the full amount of OPIF funding available, hence the reason for the proposal that you have before you to expand the OPIF. It's certainly a logical step to assume that if we're losing out on potential business as a result of the cap that we have, that if the amount were reduced, we might lose out on additional productions.
I suppose the thought is that we'll never reach that point of having enough. In other words, notwithstanding the development of infrastructure and other film-related support groups and whatnot, this $7 million or 12 or 20, whatever it turns out to be, would still be necessary.
Chair Benz, I would respectfully disagree with that assertion that we would never have enough. The proposal that you have before you today, and I think was formulated by the governor's office based on the market knowledge that they have and their interactions. I'll let them speak to that specifically. However, it is fair to say that we are in the process of cultivating an industry that can become self-sustaining in Oregon and in the Portland region. But that industry is not self-sustaining without the credit to the level that we would like it to be yet.
Yes, Representative Co-Chair Reed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I suspect you and I might be thinking the same direction here. So, Mr. Eisenbeck, how would you define when it's sufficient?
I do not have a precise definition, Co-Chair Reed, Co-Chair Benz, but certainly anecdotally talking from folks working with the industry, there are certain kinds of infrastructure that the industry depends upon that need to be rented, for instance, at this point, that the market demand is still growing to make sure that facilities and talent are available locally to supply demands.
Well, the question I was actually going to ask was going to be how much is enough. In other words, the governor suggested $12 million. How about $50 million? I mean, where do you get the where do we find out the number that's right for the market opportunity?
Chair Benz, Chair Reed, members of the committee, I believe that we would defer to the governor's Office of Film and Video on that point in terms of assessing demand in the state.
Yes, Representative Smith.
Two questions. One, first let me say, I think to the people who came now twice, right, thank you for doing that. And I think that's true. I think I speak for just about everybody on the dais. And I think that you know, there's significant recognition, at least should be on the record, significant recognition of the value of Oregon playing in the, sort of to quote a friend of mine, the content economy. I want to put that out there. Is there any, my two questions, take however you want. One, do we have anything else we want to know about the causality stuff? Anything else we want to say on the record about to help us understand causality? It's always hard. Anything else we do? I mean, heck, it's hard to know if having public schools actually is the thing that taught somebody to read. So I don't want to overstate it, but it's nonetheless really important for us to analyze. And then my second question is related to Representative Sheehan's question in the previous hearing. Are there any states that seem to do particularly well in the film industry, right, that maybe a little bit irrespective of the level of their tax break, not to say that the tax break wouldn't be important, but that are there other things we should be looking at as well as this, right? I mean, something that's like natural beauty, like we're going to, you know, build another Mount Hood, that's next session, but is there anything else that, you know, is doable?
Chair Bentz, Representative Smith, and members of the committee, I believe of the states that are not competing in the incentives, I think the only state that sees significant production is Nevada because of the Strip. So unless we're going to be building the Las Vegas Strip and all of the things that attracts, I believe that is the only state. I think that Vince Porter can verify that fact, but I think that's the only state that sees significant production.
All right. Anything else about causality stuff you want to put on the record?
I would just note, Chair Bentz, Representative Smith, members of the committee, and I think this committee heard on Wednesday from industry players that part of the appeal of Oregon is that there has been stability in the incentive program that's been provided, and so that level of market certainty is something that attracts productions to look at Oregon early in their project planning and is particularly important for productions that might take long periods of time, such as TV productions that could go into multiple seasons.
Thanks.
Yes, Representative Nathanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to follow up on something that you said. I'm not sure I understood it because it was a word that went by really quickly, but you were talking about, I think, stability in the incentives. One of the things that I think about a lot is it's interesting to me how in some cases we have various tax advantages, tax breaks of various forms. And in other cases, for other industries or projects, we hear about grants, outright grants or loans. So what is it about the way this is structured that it's important to finance our incentives this way? What if we changed the incentive to some other format, you know, grants and loans and so forth? Given that, let's say, if everyone agreed, yes, let's help the industry, what's the best way to help the industry? That's the nature of my question. And also, I guess I want to add that my interest is not in making sure that every once in a while, if there's this really cool film that might be filmed here, we have enough money to help one thing happen. I'm much more interested in knowing that we are supporting the creation, nurturing the creation, and then helping solidify an industry, a year-round industry that's providing real year-round jobs for Oregonians, not just a cool thing that happens once a year.
Chair Bentz, Chair Reed, Representative Nathanson, generally speaking, the tax credit program that Oregon has, if you were to pass House Bill 2167, would provide a greater amount of certainty than, say, a grant program that were funded just for the upcoming biennium. My understanding is that certainty is more powerful in terms of incenting behavior and attracting productions, but I would defer to the Oregon Office of Film and Video to talk about that more specifically.
Yes, Representative Weiner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Listen to this, and I mean, tax credits are something that we're dealing with there's capital gains issues. There's lots of stuff we face as a committee that we have to do to attract business to the state of Oregon. One of the things that you're doing is a lot of labor, and we see the payroll numbers and everything there, but when these shows are finished and you're out selling the advertising, the production, and all of that, where does that revenue come from? Is that done out of the state of California? Is it done out of the state of Oregon, state of Nevada? Who gets to see the tax returns on that revenue that happens from the production of these shows? With Leverage being a national show, I'm sure you're selling national advertising, things like that, and there's revenue that's seen from that, and there's taxes that are paid on that. What state does that land in?
If I might, Vice Chair Byers pointed out to me that some of the questions we've been asking probably are better put to
Vince.
To Vince. So we're going to have him back in front of us in a few minutes. So why don't we save that?
Okay.
If you don't mind, that's acceptable to the folks from Portland.
Yep.
Is the industry association with our production experience and offer testimony
on
that event as well?
Great. Is that acceptable?
That is very acceptable.
Okay.
Can I add something?
Thank you, City of Portland. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The next three folks we have signed up from a couple of days ago are John Harrison, Gretchen Miller, and Ebna Guinea. I hope I have that. Alana Guinea. Are any of those three here? I want to join Representative Smith in thanking all of those who returned for being here today. Again, John Harrison, Gretchen Miller, Alana Guinea. Not here. All right, then. Ben Willis, Jack Timmons, I think it is.
Mr. Chair, I know he came up after the hearing and noted that when he didn't raise his hand saying he could come back, he was unclear on the date and then or on the time and wasn't able to come. He said he was going to submit some written testimony instead of being here today. Okay. Mr. Timmons, that is.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Then we have Randall Groves. David Chess? Kress? Lauren Henry, Roland Sonnenberg. We have two. Let's try again. Robert Blanche. Yes. Please. And why don't we start with you?
Chair Benz, Chair Reed, members of the committee. My name is Ben Wills. I'm campaign coordinator for Tax Fairness Oregon. In front of you are some studies I've conducted in other states on their comparable film production tax incentives. I just wanted to provide you a quick summary of these studies. They collectively show that while the incentives do create jobs and new spending, the resulting increases in state revenue were unable to offset the tax of the cost of the tax credits. New state revenue increases per dollar of tax credits issued were generally in the range of 13 cents to 18 cents on the dollar. At a net loss of between 82% and 87% of the revenue impact of these incentives. The studies also show that the majority of new film production spending went to out-of-state businesses and non-residents. One study stated that if 100% of reported production budget amounts were spent purchasing goods and services within the state, the economic benefits would not be sufficient to offset the cost of the tax credits. And in that scenario, they estimated the share of tax credits recovered to be between 35% and 40%. So I hope this information will be helpful to you as you're considering your economic development priorities in the current fiscal situation. Thanks for listening to my testimony.
Thank you. And you have given us a document, recent studies of film production incentives.
That's correct.
To summarize here. Thank you very much for not reading it. We appreciate that.
And they are available for your perusal online if you care to look into them further.
Thank you. Thank you. We'll take questions at the end for the panel. So, you are.
My name is David Kress. I'm a resident of North Portland. Thank you, committee, for hearing us. I appreciate the consideration. I'm a freelance producer. Most recently, I produced the television show Portlandia. I also produced this year the film Restless, which is not out yet, but it was a Gus Van Sant film. I also do make television commercials, and part of the reason that I felt like I'd like to testify is that I'm a longtime Oregon resident. I went to Lincoln High School, Portland State University, Mount Hood Community College, and I started in film production after that, and I've worked my way up to where I'm producing television shows and movies. But I've also spent a lot of time in the commercial production world. I owned and operated a company for 11 years called Food Chain Films that did mostly advertising. And the reason I feel like I can speak to this with some authority is that I have a foot kind of in all of these different worlds. In the indigenous film production industry, that creative capital work that's year-round here, and also these special projects that come and benefit from the incentive. Some of the testimony I heard before was, are these one-time projects? And I would say, in a sense, they're project-based work, but it's no different for me than being an iron worker. Of course, I work full-time as an iron worker or a producer, but I work from one project to another project to another project. And I would suggest that most of my colleagues, like the ones you'll see there, are doing so. The nice thing about incenting the business is, for the very big project, is think of it, the analogy I use to try to explain producing away to people is it's a little bit like being a general contractor. If every once in a while we can build a big skyscraper, say that's a Los Angeles or New York or somehow international-based movie, then it puts to work a number of plumbers, electricians, iron workers, and we have the same kinds of infrastructure needs, equipment needs here that we use year-round. When we're not working on a movie, we still work. We work on television shows. We work on advertising. And now I think we're going to see a big shift to the multimedia world. It's been expressed here before that Portland has, and Oregon, the state, has a ton of advantages that aren't necessarily related to the incentive, but there are not enough yet for it to stand alone. And there's enough of demand that the amount of money put forward, I think, is a reasonable one to get us to a point where we can really have competitive advantage over other regions for this kind of work as it goes forward. I'm really excited about the prospects of Oregon taking advantage of this time when there's a little bit of upheaval in the media world, where we might find that we really are a leader in media production going forward, and I think we have that chance. So I appreciate your consideration.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, committee members, we appreciate this opportunity. My name is Robert Blanche, and I'm an actor, a Portland resident, 22 years now. And I'm also the Portland president of Screen Actors Guild. That sounds impressive, but it's a volunteer position. So I'll try to think sitcom and not feature film here. But let me, I can't speak to the numbers intelligently, so I won't do that. I know that I think from unbiased, I look at the numbers, and I'm impressed just Chair Bentz. I say, well, how does that work? Well, I know how that works. You know, it sounds like, well, that's a small amount, but if I can get $10 million or $1 million back, if I spend $10 million, well, that doesn't go in my pocket. That goes into production value. That goes back into the film. That's the whole point. Or it goes into my next project. I know that I started my film career in 94, and I had moved to Portland to be a rock star, and that wasn't working out. And I got a flyer on my car, and I said, boy, that's a sign. I'm going to get in that film. And I did, and I started working in all the films and working with Los Angeles talent. And they said, well, you work in L.A. I went down, and I couldn't get arrested in 98, and worked on a few things. And I came home and said, what am I going to do? Well, at that time, we had a lot of production here. We had a lot of production. And in 98, I did 4 movies of the week. I booked a principal role in a movie of the week. I worked with Robert De Niro on a major film here, Men of Honor. But I knew at that time that because of the Canadian dollar, it was going away. I knew it was going away because of that. So, and it did. And it dried up, and I didn't work for another 6 months until I went to Seattle and booked a Stephen King's Rose Red. After that, it got very dry. I went back to L.A. It was a bad time to go. I came home. I said, I want to live at home and work. So I opened an acting studio and started teaching. Where was the production? Our state was just as beautiful then. I'd like to answer that question. Where would they be? Where, you know, would they be here anyway? The answer is no. They weren't here. if they would have been here anyway, they would have been here. But what happened was I struggled from 2000 to 2005 to make a living. And when I lost my health care because I wasn't making enough money for my union, I was still getting calls from L.A. I moved back to L.A. Even though my children were here, and I flew home almost every weekend. It was extremely difficult. From 2005 to 2008, I flew home almost every weekend to see my children. I worked in L.A., and I worked a lot. And I built a career. Now, in 2008, I thought it'd be easier because my kids were getting older, and I said, well, you know, they don't need me around as much. They're busy, but teenagers need you badly. So I built a very good career 2005 to 2008, and I said, I'm moving home. I don't know what I'm going to do, but I'm going to move home. And I'm going to find a way to make my living here. Lo and behold, we got an incentive, and the work started coming. I now recur on Leverage. I play a recurring character. I was in Extraordinary Measures with Harrison Ford and Brendan Fraser. I'm still teaching, and I'm making a living again at home. And all these people that left, these crew members that left, because there was no work here, they're all seeing each other again. They brought their equipment and their expertise home because there are jobs. And we're all happy to be back here making a living. Now, it might seem like a small amount of people, but it doesn't look small to me when I look around and see all these people with their trucks and their goods. I'm buying new stuff, and, you know, we were just waiting for this to be after season two of Leverage. You know, I became friends with them because I'm on the show quite a bit. And, you know, you ask, and they got no reason to tell you any kind of story. Dean Devlin, I said, well, are we coming back for season three? We'll see. I mean, if that incentive comes through, we want to come back. We love Portland. And once we got it, yeah, we're coming back. And they came back. Now, the thing is, I want to speak to the transient nature. And this, well, it's a one-off. It always is. I mean, Gunsmoke isn't still on television, but they're still making other programs in Hollywood. And that's the same thing that we're building here. It's a place you want to work. They love it. And they go, well, if it isn't Leverage, we'll bring something else. And they already have. They filmed a Brain Trust. We don't know that it's going to get picked up. But if that doesn't work, and we still have an incentive, they're going to come back because they love working here. Now, I think that it comes down to, well, would they come here anyway? Would they come here anyway? How many producers does it take to change a light bulb? Does it have to be a light bulb? Okay, it comes down to the bottom line dollar. Now, these incentives are not going to go away in other states. I talked with Mr. Shedekoff. We had a very spirited, nice conversation, actually. And I understand that the difficulty with the tax, I've got a big knowledge of this, not enough to speak intelligently about it, but I do understand the pitfalls, but I don't know anything else. And maybe there are other things that bring the kind of dollars here. And you want to talk about advertising. How much does it cost to run a 30-second spot? Well, every time Leverage runs, it's a one-hour spot that nobody's paying for that ad to say. And we are getting more and more of that kind of advertising as it goes. I've read the pilot for the NBC. I mean, this is network. You know, TNT is terrific. Leverage is terrific. Network, I've worked in all of it, in television. Network is big. It's really good. NBC Universal is bringing a pilot here next month. I'm thrilled. And there's stuff in it for me to do. So I'm hoping I get in that too. But the thing is, I've read the pilot. I think it's coming, you know? But I don't think that instability and us constantly fighting to have this incentive is good, because I visit with these people and they just tell me, yeah, well, if it's solo, because these things take time to plan. They got to look at locations. They got to look at what they're going to, you know. It takes time to plan these things. So the more stable we can make it, the better I think it is. And so I'm just I'm kindly asking you to consider. You know, I don't want to leave. I don't want to leave again. I don't like it. I don't like it in Los Angeles. I like it at home, you know, and a lot of us do. And so even if, you know, no matter how it has to get done, for it to change the way it's funded, don't take it away because there's a problem with it. Because it's a small problem. It's cutting off the nose to spite the face. And I see it on the faces of every crew member and every cast member. And everybody who's building a business, and I know this money goes out, I see it being spent. And the last thing I want to say, and I apologize, this has been a feature film, not a sitcom. I want to say that I produced a film, and you know, this kind of thinking, I produced a film under the IOPF, and it was arduous. I'm an actor, you know, and I produced this film, and boy, was it hard to get our rebate. We had to jump through hoops, but we learned a ton, and we are now helping other people in our community do union films, do the paperwork. We thought it was daunting. Even though I'm the president, I had never actually done the paperwork. I now have. And I've now been through the process of getting the rebate and dotting every I. And you know what? It breeds professionalism and indigenous production. Now, when I first started, and you tell somebody in Oregon you're an actor, are you an extra? They don't believe that people actually act. No, most people live in Hollywood. If you live in Hollywood and ask and tell somebody you're in film, what do you do? We're now getting that. When I tell somebody I'm an actor, they're like, what have you been on? It's no longer, are you an extra? Because they know we have a viable films that are here. And it's just a wonderful thing. And I appreciate your time. I apologize for the length of it. But this is my chance to speak, and I appreciate it. And I would gladly take any questions.
Thank you very much. And do we have questions for this panel?
One quick one.
Yes, Mr. Reminder.
This is for you, Robert.
Yes.
Did you used to play at the Dublin Pub?
Yes. Well, I did become a rock star.
You were a taxi a couple times, too.
What's that?
You were a taxi a couple times, too.
Yeah.
I'll talk to you offline.
Okay. Thank you very much.
I did have one question for Mr. Kress. You mentioned the multimedia world. That's one of the means of getting the word about Oregon out. We haven't really maybe explored as much as we should, but maybe you could share with us your thinking on what we might, as a condition of the tax credit, require that films or other means media activities might exist in the state and could be required to do to show off Oregon, and if there's any way of doing it, because what's going to happen on these tax credit discussion is everybody's going to have a lot of the same prompts for continuing their tax credit. I'm interested in what you might say makes you different and how you could better publicize Oregon, because that's the nature of what you're about, media.
Well, I think I have an answer for that, Chair Benson. What I've noticed over the last 8 years, and I've been doing this for a very long time, but really it feels like it's really the nature of policy has been very positive for the business and helped grow the business. And that's on a statewide level and locally too in smaller communities. It's all been very positive lately. It used to take us a long time if we wanted to shoot in a state park to coordinate the transportation, the ODOT folks and the state parks folks, and to get us permission to do that kind of thing. And what we've noticed over the years is that policy has been very responsive to our needs, and they've streamlined things that used to take a long time, and that's very much it's time-based work. So we've seen a lot of changes. Another change that was made that I think is very positive in the way that you're speaking to was the small amount of the OPIF that's set aside for IOPIF to help fund indigenous production that's at a lower level. You might be aware, if any of your lawmakers are from Bend, you'll know that there was one of the first examples of IOPIF was a lower budget film produced by a gentleman named M. Blash, who's from Portland, but he produced in Bend a feature film starring Chloe Savrini, which they're working on post right now. And what I think I would say you can do is give us the funding to be a year to be able to attract larger productions in a year-round quality, which is this raise that we're talking about. And it might sound a little blithe, but last night, if anyone watched NBC, they might have seen a show called Perfect Couples, which is set in Portland, but is filmed in Vancouver, BC. The only Portland filming is they buy stock footage of Portland. Now, that television show, we probably looked at shooting here since it's based here, but it was probably an incentive situation where the incentive had been spent out. It's never, since it's been authorized, it's never funded. It's never been funded to the level that every show that could have wanted to film here would have. Now, I'm also a taxpayer, so I want to say I appreciate that we're not the best, richest tax incentive. I like the fact that it's in the lower portion, because one of the reasons that I feel good about that as a taxpayer and also as a producer is that we have certain advantages, so we don't need to be the richest program, but we are competing, and it's really a competition, which is why that show is shooting in Vancouver and not shooting here. That's why the Rudy Giuliani story was filmed in Toronto and not in New York. That's why Kit Kittredge, All-American Kid, was filmed in Vancouver, B.C., and not here. If we want to show more of Oregon, we need to be able to help people who are telling stories about Oregon tell those stories, and part of that is the incentive, because it just is a fact of life when you're funding, since there are so many other areas, states, and regions that offer incentives. One of the first questions the studios ask us, or the bankers who are backing our projects ask us, is what's the incentive situation like where you're considering shooting?
Thank you for that. And we just have a few minutes left. We have two other questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Hopefully I'll be quick. Earlier, when we were talking about other kinds of incentives, I made the point that I think it's important to be building on things that are competitive advantages for Oregon, things that we do better than other places do. And I ask Mr. Porter this regularly. What's your judgment, briefly given the time, on what kinds of film or specific technical things or things around the industry that we do better than others?
Well, some of our natural advantages, like, the fact that we're in the same time zone, it's a pretty quick flight from L.A., so you can get talent and specialized equipment and that kind of thing up. But a little bit of it is that there's just a lot of educated, underutilized capital. So I know I can go out there and find a bunch of people in a hurry who are smart, who can work enthusiastically on my projects. And I think that we have sort of a reputation as being a little underemployed as a state.
And I do know that many times you can find it in publications. I'm proud to say that the Leverage people said we had no idea we were going to find so many people that could actually guest star. Co-star is one level below. Guest star is a pretty major role for television. So we had no idea we were going to be able to book those people up there. They didn't know us here. And so I think that we do that a little bit better. We have better talent than they've found other places.
Thank you.
Thank
you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Kress, you've actually dealt with this, and you're the producer of Portlandia?
Yes.
It's a fantastic show. I'm a big fan of documentaries, so I really like that.
Thank you for watching.
I have a question about the one of the small changes to this, where it goes from 10 to 20% for Oregon. Oregon employees. I looked at that and I thought, well, there might be a risk factor. Are we just offering a bigger benefit to people who are already here, or are we really going to attract more? Can you speak to maybe how much of your budget goes to paying wages, salaries, and benefits for work done in Oregon by employees who are residents of Oregon?
Well, we're pretty well administered, I think, in that way. Speaking as a taxpayer, I feel like there's a lot of protections built in for us. Different states administer the incentive in different ways, and I've shot in other states, so I know about this. But I'm proud to say, as a taxpayer, that we administer our incentive pretty well, and there it means that the money that's offered as a lure and an incentive is for Oregon employment, not for other people's employment. So that's pretty good, and I think we're doing that now. I think that what happens is we build this infrastructure of human capital as well as the other kinds of things, the lights and the other kinds of equipment that we use, that there'll be a greater confidence from producers outside that they can get more in-state. It's kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy. The more production that's going on, the more there's sort of this sense of the path gets a little more well-worn, if you will, because there's confidence, and they just keep coming, and they expect to get more from Oregon. And believe me, as a producer, you don't like bringing people from out of state because it's expensive. So if there's the perception is they're there, they'll try to find it here first.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
You know, just if the answer is really short, go ahead, because we've got...
It is. I'm looking for the answer to is, as a percentage, say you spend $100,000 on your production that's subject to this this credit. I'm just trying to figure out how much of that is going to Oregon wages, salaries, not necessarily lights, cameras, site work, whatever, catering. I'm trying to figure out what the impact of this number changing is going to be. So out of like $100,000 that you spend on an episode, how much of that do you think is going to wages, benefits? Wages, salaries, and benefits.
If you can keep
it's the biggest part. I don't know
really
an exact answer, but labor is generally the biggest part of our budget.
So 60%?
That would be safe.
Okay.
On the IOP, ours was 70% of it was labor.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Thank you, panel. And I think our last three are Betty Moyer, Edward Taub, and Vince Porter. And I'm not sure if we have... Is Betty Moyer here? There she is. And do we have Edward Taub?
Yes, sir.
Please come up. And Vince Porter. And is there anyone else that's going to want to testify? Raise your hand if there is.
Like I said, I can offer more information on the cause of...
Okay, but we'll have to have you say that on the record, so...
Sure.
Okay, let's start with Mr. Taub.
Thank you.
And if I may, we're down to 7 minutes.
Okay. Well,
so
then
if you
I'll
can
talk
keep your,
fast. I'm from New York.
Have,
I can do
you
that.
You have three of them.
My name is Edward Taub. I'm the staff representative for the American Federation of Television and Radio Artists, AFTRA. We represent, among other people, freelance actors in Oregon. And many of our members have worked as a result of the incentive program. And to be an actor in this market means you can't just do television or feature films or theater or commercials or training films or teaching. You have to try to do a combination of both and cobble together your profession and a living doing that. I just want to say that the incentive program and the work that it provides to the acting community is critical for a number of our members, at least, to get health insurance and retirement. And to get those credits towards, for a period of time beyond the work that they do. The other thing I wanted to say really briefly then is that even though these jobs may be a one-time job for those that don't have a recurring role, the income that they derive and therefore the taxes they pay continues. So that, for example, if an actor is in an episode of Leverage, that person would receive income, pay taxes on that, and then for reruns, DVD sales, foreign sales, and so on, anytime that it's shown, they'll derive more income, pay more taxes, and so that, the wealth that's created, the revenue that's created to the state is greater than just the initial salary that goes out to the actor. Since time is short, I'll cut myself at that. And
thank you very much. We appreciate you putting your testimony into that limited time. And with that, Ms. Moyer.
Thank you. I'm an actress. I'm going to keep very brief. I also have worked with Robert on many projects. It was the same sort of thing. We had an opportunity back then. We had major films, we had television going on, and it all dried up, went to Canada because of their incentive and the dollar and all that. Now we have another opportunity. We can create another Hollywood here, just like we were beginning to do then before it dried up and went up there to Vancouver. We have that chance again, and all I ask is don't take it away from us again. Let us build something here because we want to work here, we want to live here, and I thank you for your time.
Thank you for your patience, Vince. Oh, I'm sorry. And let's go back for a moment. Although I called you Ms. Moyer, I didn't ask you to state your name.
Oh, Betty Moyer.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Benz, Chair Reed, and members of the committee. I know we're running out of time, and there were a couple really important points that I wanted to follow up on. Since I wrote the original legislative concept back in June, I wanted to explain some of the thought process why I submitted what it was. $20 million was what we put in for the cap. And when you brought up, Chair Benz, the question, what's enough? At the time, I put that in because I imagined sort of there is a capacity right now in the state. There is a level based on the amount of crew that we have in Oregon that we can fill. And I've seen it happen in other states where there is no limit. There is no capacity issue. That what ends up happening is people show up to their state and have a miserable experience and bring in people from out of state that they didn't plan for. And I felt like at $20 million, that was sort of the max of what we currently can accommodate. I know that, you know, everyone probably is always eager to say more, 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 and more, but that was my analysis based on our crew base and our talent and what we had available. The 20% Oregon resident statute that was in here also was tied to the $20 million. Figure in that if we did bring in enough work that filled out the $20 million, we've heard some comments about that we want to make sure that they are hiring the Oregon residents first. In the way that our labor expenditures do work, if anyone works in Oregon, they're taxed in Oregon. So if you live in Vancouver, Washington, or whatever, you're being taxed in Oregon. And unlike other tax treaties, we looked into this year, no matter where you work, you still are responsible for paying Oregon taxes no matter where you work. And so the notion of the 20% Oregon increase was the thought that we would provide an added incentive to make sure that you're absolutely exhausting the Oregon resident pool.
Vince, if you could wind it up in 1 minute, because
yeah.
Otherwise Representative Greenlick is going to become very angry and upset.
I'll do it in 30 seconds. I know. No, thank you. So that was the reason why I think at a different level, I think that particular number is worth revisiting. Because I think we have shown that we are hiring a lot of people. And my last comment is Hollywood North. It makes me cringe. I moved from Hollywood to take this job, and I think we can create something unique and special to Oregon that doesn't have to be branded as Hollywood.
We appreciate that, Vince. Thank you very much. See no questions. We're adjourned.
Surely,